dB, you're actually 3.01 dB. So it's the loss in the cable is T1, 10 times the log of T1 over T2. Back to you, Dick, and to Leo. I just thought I'd throw that in there. And if he doesn't want to do the calculation, he can just compare one cable to another, shorted or open. Perfect cable, if it had zero loss and you put 20 watts into it, 20 watts would come back. And you could use that as a guide.
Hey, that guy Rich Tashner is becoming very mathematical in his days. He's quoting formulas off the top of his head. Well done. That's exactly the right formula. 10 times the log, base 10 log, of P1 over P2 is decibels of round trip. The signal has been up, hit the short circuit or hit the open circuit, and reflected back. So in his example, 10 watts up, 20 watts up, 10 watts coming back, is a 3.01 dB round trip loss. Therefore, the cable has got 1.5 dB of loss one way. You got to divide by two. But he's got the right formula. Well done. One other thing I wanted to tell you, Steve, that when you go to the stockyard and you talk them into giving you one of these wooden reels of leftover cable, you're going to have a little bit of a problem of vocabulary. You would call one of their kinds of cable 3/4 inch, 0.75 inch cable. You ask them for 3/4 inch hardline, they'll say, what the hell are you talking about? You ask them for 750 cable, they say, yeah, I know what you're talking about. They call it 750. The cable that's a 7/8 of an inch diameter, 0.875, they don't call a 0.78, 7/8 inch hardline. They call it a 875 cable, and so on. So they've got 750, 875, 125, and so on, 1.25 inch cable. So you got to speak their vocabulary, and you want the stingers that go along with it. Good luck with that project, Steve, and let us know how it turns out. And 70 ohm cable hardline, you're listening to 100 foot length of it right now. So that's how I talk to this particular antenna, 70 ohm hardline, going up my particular tower. And I didn't even build any kind of impedance adapters on each end to convert the 70 ohms to 50. It's an extremely minor perturbation, unless you're running a moonbound system where you've got to, get the last tenth of a dB of insertion loss. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. Paul's going to tell us what's going on in space, and maybe Paul's even got some questions and comments on what he's all heard. WS2N with a little bit of delay. And don't forget to listen every 2 minutes to drop the machine, Paul. K2RIW. You got it, Paul.
K2KEY.
Hold on there, Paul. Go ahead, Mel.
He's laughing at the reels. He doesn't want a reel. I used a number of those reels and made excellent little backyard tables, Dick, over.
Now, Steve, you can tell we have three reasons why you're going to take that reel. It makes some nice, rugged, rustic-looking backyard furniture. It makes the guy happy. And it's the nicest way to get a real neat roll of hardline cable in your hand. What you do with it after that is your choice. But for you to unreel it from his reel and then re-reel it up again in order to put it into your truck, you're going to end up with twice as many dents as you want. I don't recommend that. Take your own sweet time doing it in your own backyard by taking the wooden reel apart. Okay, yep, you got it, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, yeah. Years ago, I took a reel home. That was empty just because I wanted a table, so a work table in the backyard. And just like Mel said, it would work great. It must have taken 10 years for the bottom to eventually rot out. I mean, I could have even fixed it up more and kept it, but eventually I got rid of it. But about 10 years, you know, you could always cut the bottom off or put the bottom up on stands or whatever you want to do. You could be creative with that, but it makes a great work table for the backyard. Mel's right. One comment before I give the space report. I use all these different chemicals and sticks to clean VCRs, a couple of VCRs I had. We talked about a few weeks ago. And by the way, it worked very good. I mean, I got everything running 100%. Clean rollers and this and that. And there was really nothing mechanically wrong with these things. So you can keep them going. I mean, eventually something will fail, but apparently the cleaning is an important thing. I mean, you know, you can tell that the tape is, whatever's on the tape, the oxide is coming off on plastic rollers and metal rollers all over everywhere, and it's very hard to see, but I mean, when you use the cleaner and these cotton swabs, special swabs that I bought, it really worked quite well. Let me drop it. Ran tests with them, recorded on different speeds. The slow speed used to be impossible. Now you play it back, you can barely tell the difference between the EP speed or the SP speed. Remarkable difference. So, thanks for the advice on the net. Got a lot of information from the internet itself, and worked out okay. Space report, Dick. Do you want that?
I sure do, but let me interrupt you for a couple of minutes. I just realized I made a mistake. Joe signed in with a real question, and somehow I skipped over him. Have the A2RYY, go right ahead with your question, Joe.
You know, there's almost a 1 second delay between you speaking on your repeater and what comes out of my IRLP node. So when you drop it, it's very hard for somebody in the IRLP to get back in it, because by the time you wait for that beep, you're already talking, and it's kind of tough. Yeah, I do have a real question. I'd like to know more about ground testers.
Okay, that sounds good. What would you like to know, as if I didn't know? Go ahead, Joe.
Well, if I ask a specific question, like how they work or whatever, you know, I might get a specific answer, but if I ask a question in general, like I just said, I'd like to know more about it, maybe it'll cover the part of the topic of how do they work and how they can be used enhance an amateur installation somewhere, or even commercial installation. Go ahead.
Okay, I've got some guesses as to what you want to know or how it's being used. If you really installed a grounding system for protection of a building, protection of a radio tower, or whatever, and you have to meet a certain specification before you get paid, before the contract is completed, and they want you to confirm that there's less than half an ohm of resistance between two separate grounding rods that are separated by X number of feet, for you to measure that number of ohms has to be done in an AC manner. Logically, you'd think you just take your triplet model 630 in the old days, or your Simpson 260, and connect it to the two rods with the known resistance of wiring in between, and measure resistance. Well, you do that, you're going to come up with a high number than reality, because as the typical ohm meter pours current into a system like a resistor that it's measuring, in the case of ground, you start polarizing that ground. One of those rods becomes an anode, one becomes a cathode. You've got this electrolyte in between, which is soil with some mineral matter in it and water. And so it builds up a small coating that you can't even see, a microscopic coating, on one of those rods at least, and you end up with the wrong number. So to my knowledge, a ground testing system doesn't do it with a DC source, it does it with an AC source. So it is measuring, it is putting a small amount of AC voltage through a known dropping resistor into the system under test and measuring the voltage drop across its internal series resistor and interpreting that into ohms. That's what I think it does. Anybody with any further comments on that, give me a call at us right now if you really know how a ground testing system works. K2RYW listening.
K2KEY, own the instrument.
Okay. Here's a man who's got one. He's put his hands on it, used it, knows what it smells like and tastes like. Go right ahead, Bill.
Hey. It's a funny-looking instrument. It's in a wooden box, of course. It had to be a wooden box. Even though it's not as old as, you know, you would think it would be. May have been built in the 40s, I think. It has a crank on it. It's a handle. It comes out the side, folds out. And you crank it. It's got a little generator in there, Dick. And it's got two calibrated lengths of wire. And what you do with that piece is you plug the thin things into the ground. And, for instance, you could check, like I fooled around with, you know, and different times with it. basically I check the, you know, the ground rod, between ground rods and things like that. And it gives you the dielectric constant of the soil, and also reads conductivity, and it's in, it has like a S/M on the meter, Dick, over.
Yeah, I am guessing that the S/M stands for Siemens per meter, which is somewhat equivalent to Mohs per meter. And those are the units of conductivity. Mo, M-H-O, really is ohm, O-H-M, spelled backwards. And it's a measure of conductivity versus resistivity. 1 over resistance is equal to conductance. So if I had a 1 ohm resistor, and I'm putting it in parallel with some circuit, I'm using it in the so-called conductive manner, not the resistive manner, and that would be 1 mo of conductivity, and in the modern vocabulary, it'd be called 1 Siemen, because Mr. Siemen is the famous guy that they decided to attach that parameter to his name. In the example I gave before, where you're putting your little generator, your hand crank generator, I am guessing is putting out an AC voltage. And so when it measures Siemens per meter, and if you follow its rules, I am guessing you take these two standard rods of some standard length, sink them into the ground at some standard depth with some standard spacing between the rods. When you meet all of those standards, the numbers that it comes up with are then the resistivity of your soil. It's measuring some number of, you and I would call it ohms, they call it Mohs or Siemens. But once you've got a defined volume of dirt in between those two rods, that conductivity is now Siemens per meter, is the unit resistivity, the volumetric resistivity of your particular soil. By measuring the phase shift of that AC current that flows, it makes an interpretation of capacitance. I presume that capacitance is in nanofarads or picofarads. What kind of units of capacitance does it indicate them? And how it measures the phase shift to measure the capacitance, I'd really like to know how it does that, if you happen to know, Mel. K2KEY with a little delay. K2RIW.
Haven't looked at it in a long, long time. I think it's right on the shelf. You want to continue for a couple of minutes when you get, you know, chance, we can do a discussion on it. I'll go get the instrument. And I'll tell you what it looks like and what it tells you on it. It's quite a fascinating thing. I mean, I actually stumped a lot of years ago. I showed it to a few people. And they said, I had no idea what it is. I said, well, look at this crank handle. What do you think that's for? They said, well, maybe so you don't have to use batteries. I said, nope, it's not for that. It's not for self-powering. It's the part of the operation of the instrument. So I can go get it, and we can get a little bit more of a discussion on it, Dick, if you like. Over.
That sounds like a nice piece of memorabilia or history you got there, Mel. How many years ago did you get it? Where'd you get it from? How many dollars do you think it was worth in those days? Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I bought it at an auction. Yep, bought it at an auction. You know, I was always going to these auctions years ago. They used to have so many of them around. Laboratories cleaning out stuff. So I used to go to these different auctions, and I bought a lot of instruments and things. And I also bought for the company at times. We needed certain things that were available, and I said, listen, I was a nice, good employee that I saved them money. Not that I think they really appreciated it at the end, just the certain things that transpired, but I used to buy a lot of, you know, times we needed instruments, such as the Hewlett-Packard I was just mentioning earlier, that down converter for the generator, and, you know, those things are a phenomenal amount of money. And I would search around, and I'd buy these things. So I go to these auctions and all pick up stuff, instruments and things, and sometimes I see something, you know, personally for myself that I like, so I bid on it. And I think I bid at that time, maybe, maybe $25, I think, Dick. I'll get the instrument, and I'll tell you, describe it. Quite interesting. Over.
Fantastic. Take your time. I'm going to turn it back to Joe for any questions or comments. Then we're going to pick up with Paul's completion of his space report. And then we'll come back and discuss the ground resistivity measurement meter. Sounds like a fun thing. You don't see very many of those nowadays on flea markets. So back to you, Joe. I wonder if that's close to what you were looking for data on those things, what little we know on them. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, what I've seen is advertised in, like, say, a commercial product catalog like Tesco. They make I don't recall a company that makes these things, but they make a couple of different varieties of it. Basically, this thing is a clamp-on device. It'll clamp on, say, like the ground wire of a tower. It'll give you basically the resistance. It'll tell you the resistance of that connection through whatever means it does. That's probably more of what my question, I guess, was based on. The theory of how that works. It's not measuring across two points, it's measuring across around a ground conductor itself. I was more curious on the technique or the theory of operation of how something like that actually works and how well it works.
Yeah, I think when Mel reads the instruction manual that comes with his machine, where if I understand correctly, it probably was originally supplied with known diameter, known length, rods of known material, and you put them some fixed preferred distance apart in your soil, and then the number it comes up with is hopefully traceable to the Bureau in units of Siemens per meter of resistivity, volumetric resistivity of your particular soil. I'm kind of amazed that it also measures capacitance, which I guess is now going to be a function of what kind of mineral matter he's got in his soil. I'm still a bit amazed on that capacitance one. But the only way, see, the way a capacitance works is it creates a phase shift. If I took a perfect capacitor of, let me pick a number, 001 microfarads, and it's a perfect capacitor, and I put it across the 110-volt line, you and I know how to calculate 1 over 2 pi FC, the capacitive reactance at 60 cycles, for a 001 capacitor. That capacitor, I'm going to pick a number out of the air. Let's assume, because I'm putting 120 volts AC and I'd like the mathematics to come out right, I'm going to pick up a phony number and say, make believe the capacitor reactance was 1,200 ohms. 1,200 ohms across a 120 ohm circuit would create a AC current of a tenth of an ampere, 100 milliamps. And that 100 milliamps of AC current would be exactly 90 degrees leading in phase compared to the voltage coming out of that light by power line. The current would be 90 degrees leading. That's just the way a perfect capacitor works. If I now start putting a less and less perfect capacitor, my capacitor has got a really bad capacitor. It's got exactly 1,200 ohms of series resistance, equivalent series resistance. So now my capacitor is 1,200 ohms of resistance and 1,200 ohms of capacitance in series. And that combination is put across the 110-volt line. Instead of getting 90 degrees of phase shift, I'd get exactly 45 degrees of phase shift. Instead of getting 100 milliamperes of current flow, I would get the quadrature quarter sum of those two values. I think it would be the square root of the sum of the squares. I think it's the way it works. You have to do a vector sum when you've got the two values. The resistive voltage drop is going to be in phase. The capacitive voltage drop is going to be 90 degrees out of phase. And you're putting the two in series. But by its measuring total current RMS and phase shift, you now could take that capacitor and resistor that were in a black box. And nobody told you what they were. But they told you it will tolerate a 110-volt line. You put it across the 110-volt line. You measure the phase angle and the magnitude of current. And if you're smart enough with mathematics, you can figure out exactly what was in that box, assuming that it was a series circuit of an R and a C. Well, your soil is doing something like that. It is a kind of a series R and a series C, depending on how much mineral matter and how much moisture and so on. So that's part of what I think that thing is doing. And as Mel reads his instruction manual that comes with it, And after Paul gives us our space report, I think we can dig a little bit deeper into soil characteristics. Sure, it's nice to know what your soil is as far as its bearing strength for holding up a tower, its resistivity for creating a good grounding system for lightning protection or human safety, high voltage safety to make sure that nobody gets a shock. Back to you, Paul. WS2M.
Reflector 9126. Link clear.
Yeah, looks like we timed that out. Is there any way we can reestablish that, Eric?
Yeah, you can if you just be quiet for about a minute and change. That means no keying up.
Okay, I'll be quiet for a minute and change.
Oh, somebody blows. You know what? I'll dial it up directly.
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Channel 6.
Go ahead, Dick.
Sounds like we're back on the air. And I presume we timed it out because we didn't wait for a complete drop, like probably 5 seconds worth once in a while. And what's the length of time that causes that timeout, Eric? In other words, is it once every 5 minutes we must allow for a complete drop of, let's say, 10 seconds?
Yeah, ILP times out at about 4 minutes. So if you, in the process of 4 minutes, don't let it drop at least until you hear the beep, and I made the beep a little bit longer spaced so that we can try and avoid that, but you got to let it drop once in a while, otherwise it goes away.
Okay. Well, once again, we've learned our lesson. We have to do a little bit more dropping. Okay. Paul, make sure every 2 minutes or so you create a gap. WS2N, I hope they're going to find some water on the moon, but I'm a little bit worried as to how much water and is it going to be enough to be useful. I also saw a recent article in Newsday that, let me think now, Aldrin, I guess it was, is telling Obama that we should be going back to the moon and planning on a mission to Mars. I think the mission to Mars is a bit optimistic, but that's what he said. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW. Let it drop.
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, Aldrin is the best advocate for the space program. Always has been. Wonderful. Really does a good job. Yeah, I hope they pour some money into the program. Looks like, you know, there is some talk that they want to cut back, which is kind of strange. They have a good program going, and they ought to go forward with it. Mars is a little out there, but, I mean, the plan is to use this whole constellation set up eventually to go to Mars. I'd be happy if they can try to go to the moon, or at least the process of going to the moon. Getting there is half the fun anyway. So, I'm looking forward to that. And speaking of that, on the 27th, which is Tuesday, 8 o'clock in the morning, the Ares 1X rocket will be taking off from Florida on pad 39A. And then on pad 39B, a mile and a half away, you have Atlantis getting ready for its flight in November. Let me drop it. I'm looking forward to the Ares launch. That'll be the first launch of the whole constellation series. It is suborbital, 150,000 feet. Probably, I think they said 28 miles high. So you'll have a 2-minute burn on the solid booster rocket, and that'll separate, and then you have another secondary rocket on top of that, and it'll cut off early. It won't go into orbit. The solid will come down and land in the ocean. That'll be recovered, and all these solid boosters will be recovered and reused. and then there's 700 instruments attached to the whole spacecraft, which will and rocket, which will be sending telemetry back on how everything works and how everything, you know, performing. You know, they do have to. They've got gimbaling involved and make sure this whole thing goes okay. So they're pretty confident about it. It's sitting on the launch pad. We drop it. There was some talk about maybe we shouldn't have the space shuttle sitting out there, but they're so confident that even though it's a mile and a half away, they don't think it's going to be a problem. Let's just launch this one. So I guarantee that'll be on the news. It's unmanned, but being the first of anything, that should make the news. The newspapers, of course, the internet. So you go to NASA.com for any updates on that. You can they have a press kit you could download. I think it's around 3 megs. You could read about the flight, you know, what's involved, the equipment that's on board, and you know, what's going to transpire on you know, 8 o'clock. And they have a window open from 8 o'clock until 12 o'clock that day on Tuesday. So I thought I'd mention that. I've mentioned it before, but 2 days from now, they will launch. And we'll evaluate it maybe next week. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Very good, Paul. Sounds like something to look forward to. No word yet on water on the moon. Is that true?
Last week I read about it, and they're at least a couple of weeks away from making some kind of an evaluation. All they said was that there is plenty of information from the spacecraft and from the land-based telescopes. And they're combining everything, and they expect to make an announcement within a week or two. So, I don't know, Dick. I don't think they found what they were looking for. I thought they were going to have a bigger splash or whatever. Media-wise, I think it was a dud. Scientific-wise, I'm sure a lot of information. Sometimes the lack of what they expected might be information for them. They might have hit something harder. They probably didn't hit something as soft as they would have liked. I hope they don't do it again. I'd like to just see some soft landings down there and on a South Pole and on a North Pole, and get some robots out there, some crawlers out, you know, similar to what we have on Mars with the Spirit and Opportunity, and do some work like that instead of, you know, smashing things into the moon. Back to you, Dick.
I see. Paul, if you were a betting man, would you bet there's an 80% probability that there wasn't a significant amount of water and a 20% probability that there was? Is that about the way you would bet it, Paul? Go ahead.
I'm going to say whatever their expectations were, cut it in half. That's from the results. I thought they might have a little bit better when I first heard about this. You know, they've done this before. They've done it with Pathfinder. It was called Prospector. Prospector was the spacecraft that they had crashed into the moon previously. And that was a dud, too. You know, they expected a big, some kind of reaction with that. And that came in at a six degrees impact with the surface. This thing was almost 90, you know, and I mean, they got something out of it where they could see it, but I don't know. Hopefully they'll come up with, you know, maybe 50%. Make it worthwhile. Don't forget, you know, you do need to have some kind of liquid there that you can melt down, some kind of ice that you can melt down, create water, create oxygen, create hydrogen fuel. You need this stuff to bring everything to the moon. $10,000 a pound. You work your weight in gold. That's big money.
Yep. $10,000 a pound. Boy, if I was worth that much, I could almost retire on that. Sounds good. Thank you, Paul. Let's see if Mel's got some further words on how it measures capacitance, and is it a, I'm pretty sure when you hand crank, you're hand cranking a dynamo, I think it is. It's a set of slip rings on a rotating coil in a magnetic field that makes an AC signal, is my guess as to how it works. Let me think now. When it comes to wooden boxes and significant looking instrumentation 20, 30, 40 years ago with a nice great big meter on it, I wonder if the brand name is Weston. They made some very nice meters. Let's see what Mel found out if he did. K2KEY. That's some drop. K2RIW.
Hey, this is Jerry. Let me take one more standby. Okay, nobody. All right, let me describe it first. It is a nice wooden box. You know, remember the instruments in the nice wooden boxes? That'd be a fancy mahogany box, of course. Nice finish on it. It has a height that stands 5 inches high, and it's standing on two wooden legs, nice piece of wooden legs that are about an inch and a half, raises the whole box up about an inch and a half off the table. Its width is 5 inches, and its depth is 10 inches. Now, you look at this thing, on top, there's a cover that opens, an iron cover, like a cast iron cover, no, what is it, mass, aluminum casting cover, and inside there is a meter that's 5 inches wide by 3 inches wide. That's the meter. And on the cover, it says on the top of that, R-E-C-O-R-D, record. That's what says record. If you open the cover, and you look in, it's a hinged cover. Very, very nice the way it is. It says record, and it's made in Broad Heath, B-R-O-A-D, Heath, H-E-A-T-H, England. Made in Broad Heath, England. And it has in it, it says caution, high voltage AC. Okay. On this box, on one end of the box, is this, the crank handle. Very nice crank handle. Beautiful finish on it. Let me give it a crank. Okay, that's it. Crank's over. Sounds like a whole gearbox in there. On the other side of the casing, there's two hefty terminals mounted on a Bakelite, this old black Bakelite material, and it says on it, Earth, Earth, and a switch right above it, it says 1, 10, divide by 1, 10, or 100, Dick, over.
That was a nice, let me drop. That was a nice sound effect when you ground the handle. It sounded like a, I think they call them Galloping Gertie or whatever. This great big yellow box that people used to have for transmitting an emergency signal with a great big hand crank on the top. It sounded like that. So it's a British-made thing. And is there an instruction manual with it? And is that tucked into the cover? Back to you, Mel.
Negative. No instruction on it. The way I got it, I guess, long gone. And yeah, sounds like, if I could say, you reminded me of the World War II called the Gibson Girl. What they, you know, they used to, I guess, put them in the life rafts. To, and they, I think I remember seeing one at our museum at Floyd Bennett when we were there, you know, in the, where they have the aircraft and all. They had another section that, you know, we didn't walk over to where they had, yes, aircraft, antique radio equipment and all from World War II. Gee, you know, we never looked at that, Dick, until I looked at it only recently. I don't think you were with me that time when we looked at, I think we were just looking at engines and planes, but they got some interesting products there, including that Gibson Girl. Now, the meter reads S/M 0.001 to 8, and then dielectric 2 to 1,000, Dick, over.
Okay, that may be relative dielectric constant. Relative dielectric constant, I mean, Teflon is something like, was it 2.5 or so, some kinds of plexiglass, or around 2.8. In other words, if you take two plates of a air space capacitor that are nice and flat and parallel to each other, and you measure the capacitance, usually in picofarad, and then fill up that space with your unknown insulating material, like plexiglass, Teflon, mica, whatever, the capacitance will increase when you do that. And the number of times the capacitance increases, that's very close to the dielectric constant of your unknown material. So I guess that's what it's telling you. But I'm still... is there a switch that you flip in order to get into the capacitance mode versus the Siemens per meter mode? Or do somehow those two readings come out simultaneously? Roughly, how does that work, if you can tell, Mel? Go ahead with an updrop.
Okay. By the way, it's the U.S. distributor, sounds kind of thing, is Herman Strict, Herman H. Strict, S-T-I-C-H-T, Strict Company, Incorporated, New York, New York. That was the American distributor of it. How old is it? I'd say it goes back maybe the 40s. Anyhow, I don't know how they do it, Dick. I never had it apart. It's not an easy thing. The way it was put together, it is really put together quite well. I don't know how it comes apart. It's too, looks like the cabinet was put together, but I don't see any screws to open it up. I never did anything really with it. They give you, like I say, these prods. I guess you can call them prods, not probes, prods, that you put in, you hook onto these terminals on the end, and you poke them in, you turn the crank, and, I guess you can look at a chart. Let's say what? Let me remember. If you have, I think, fresh water, pure fresh water, if you're measuring, I think it used to, what, it had a Siemens, I think was what, 0.001, am I correct, Dick, over?
You might be talking about loss tangent of water. As a dielectric constant, water at most of the frequencies we care about is very close to 81, dielectric constant. But loss tangent of water as a dielectric material, I think it's something like 0.02. The lower the number, the worse, the better it is. Teflon, for instance, has a loss tangent of something like a quadruple 2, quadruple 4, something like that. It's a fancy way of saying it's a very high quality dielectric material, Teflon. Very few things are better than that. But water is, as a dielectric material, you make a capacitor out of water. At least when you use water of typical mineral content, it's a rather yucky capacitor. Since water's resistivity becomes almost a perfect insulator, if the water is pure enough, demineralized water, loss tangent would improve. Nope. Because the loss tangent is a function of how well those molecules try to flip back and forth the polarized molecule of water and follow the voltage of the impressed voltage waveform, that's where the loss is coming from. And I suspect water is going to stay as a very lossy material, no matter how pure it is, at RF frequencies. Obvious by the fact that Mr. Southworth, when he first wanted a dummy load for his great big piece of waveguide, he put his piece of waveguide at a slanted angle into a trough of water, and that wedge of water inside became a nearly perfect absorber of the RF energy flowing down the waveguide. And I think he was doing those experiments way back in 1938. Back to you, Mel. Oh, one last question. Do you see a knob or a lever that you could switch in order to go into the times 1, times 10, times 100 scale? Is there any other knob or lever that you could switch to flip between the resistivity mode and the capacitive mode? I mean, how do you decide that you're going to read the Siemens per meter scale or the other scale? Give it up, drop time, and back to you, Mel.
Okay. I don't see that, Dick. I think what it's based on, actually, what is it based on, most likely, is the, what they, I guess it's known as, what, the respective conductivities and dielectric constants of Earth, so that you could actually label the Earth, knowing what the dielectric constants are. What do we got? Poor characteristics, very poor characteristics, average, very good, and so on. In other words, if I remember reading that if you look at the New York area where we're living, and like a park around here or something, it has a dielectric constant, I believe, around 13, if I'm not mistaken. And if you look at like salt water, which is down the corner, if you go down there, so measuring there, I think you got salt water has a dielectric constant of 81. I think that's basically what they're looking at here, Dick. Over.
Does stand to reason that the mineral content in the soil would make a difference in measurement. It's beginning to sound like somehow they've combined the readings, and you can look at that scale and read whichever scale you want. It's a little unsettling for me, though, because I can see how various mineral contents and various moisture contents of various kinds of soil can have nearly identical resistivity with different phase angles, therefore a different amount of capacitance. That's my gut feel on that. But Joe is going to do some more research on this one because he's interested in the way these things are measured. And when he makes that discovery, he's going to come back and tell us what he discovers. That's what I hope will happen. Let me make sure I haven't skipped anyone else or anyone from out of area that wants to add a question on comment on what they've heard so far. Give me a call, that is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
More thing, Dick.
Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, as you're referring to it, in other words, you're referring to the with frequency angle of variation. I think you're looking at now the how dielectric constant and conductivity refer to, I believe they call it the Suedo Brewster angle situation, that, like, for different frequencies. Is that what you're alluding to, Dick? Over.
Yeah. Whenever I put a capacitor into a circuit, and there's an AC voltage flowing through that circuit, I don't care if it's 60 cycles or 60 megacycles, the capacitor in the circuit will create a phase shift. Let's not discuss this how much. So a capacitor is going to create a leading phase shift. An inductor, if you put one in, is going to create a lagging phase shift. So there's going to be a phase shift, and it's going to probably change as a function of frequency. And this circuit, I'm pretty sure that the probes you put into the soil are going to look at that soil as a volumetric material having both resistivity and, let me think now, what's the word for that? Susceptance, yeah? Susceptance is the conductive equivalent of capacitance. So we're measuring permittivity. It's amazing how many words they've got for measuring the quality and the characteristics of things. When you measure impedance, impedance consists of resistance plus J times reactance. The opposite of 1 over resistance, we call that, we use Z for resistance, we use Y for the 1 over Z, and I keep forgetting the word for Y. It consists of conductance and... Say that again?
Admittance.
That's the right word. That sounds like Paul. Thank you, Paul. Admittance, which is a combination of the resistive component, which is called conductance, and the reactive component is called susceptance. So if you want to measure all the qualities of something, you're measuring impedance, resistance, reactance, admittance, conductance, susceptance. permittivity and permeability. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's a relationship between them, but there's 8 words you could use for measuring the qualities of a solid chunk of some substance. And that can be awfully confusing. I'm going to give you that one. And when it comes to all the different terms they use for measuring magnetic characteristics, lines and Webers and Oersteds, Gauss, and Tesla, it just goes on and on and on. And when it comes to all the units they use for measuring light properties and brightness, again, they got a whole lot of terms. These things are a little bit complicated. Nobody said the world's got to be simple. And can all of this stuff be made simplified? Well, the guys who signed into the TechNet make an attempt at that. I'll warn you, they don't always succeed. And we don't always know. A smart person, as Clint Eastwood said, you got to know your limitations. A smart person knows something about what he doesn't know. In some of those areas, I'll admit you, I feel a little bit uncomfortable. What else can you tell us about that machine, Mel? And what a piece of equipment. What's your guess as to the year of manufacture? K2KEY with a delay, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, that wasn't me, by the way. This is WS2N. It must have been someone else that made the comment.
There's a man named Paul who lives in Comac, and I think that was the Paul.
Okay, very good. I understand. By the way, I have a comment about the Gibson girl. I looked that up on the Internet. A very good thing that Mel just brought up.
Hey, give us a couple of words on Gibson girl. Delay first, and then turn it over to Mel when you're through. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm interested in Mel's box there too. But they show it. It's got this hourglass shape to it. You put it between your legs, and you could, there's a crank on top, and you can crank it using it in that fashion. It has 800 feet of wire on a reel that could reel out, and you attach it to a balloon. They have some kind of hydrogen generator to create hydrogen to put into a 4-foot balloon or a metal kite. You need that to hold the end of the wire, and it reels out. And then there's some kind of a rope stay that you would attach to the boat if you're floating around on a little raft somewhere, and that would hold roughly the middle of the the end of the antenna. And then you have a clip to clip on for your wire to connect to your transmitter. And you're able to either send CW because you could send manually or SOS and drop it. You could send SOS, automatically. This thing transmits on 500 KC or, 8,260 KC. So, they are two frequencies. But the earlier ones apparently only did 500 KC for emergency transmitting. And that's pretty much it. A remarkable looking gadget, though. Apparently designed by the Germans, something was called a knot sender by the Germans. The British tried to copy it. They had found it. The British found it, and they tried to copy it, but they didn't have the manufacturing capability. So the United States started making them, and they were used all the way up until the mid-1960s, they said, Dick. Back here.
I wonder if the article you found on the Internet, let me drop it for long enough. I wonder if the article you found on the Internet gave you any hint as to how successful it was. You talked about a great big long chunk of wire that can be flown with a kite or with a hydrogen balloon. I guess there's some way of generating hydrogen for the balloon. You didn't mention how you ground the other end of the thing. I wonder if there's a ground wire. And did they ever mention how many people were really rescued with this thing? Did it work? or is it just something you give to people to give them a warm, fuzzy feeling, but maybe it didn't work so well in reality? Back to you, Paul.
I don't know. It was made in the 40s, and they kept it into operation to the mid-60s. So I guess they must have used it to some degree. It also came with a parachute if you wanted to drop this thing to somebody that's floating around down there. I'm not sure why you would need to do that, because then you would know where they were. So, it's more or less what it is when it was invented. And the operation of it, not so much its historical value and what it's, you know, I guess you could search the internet for different sites under that topic, tell you something like that. But no, I don't see anything about the, you know, how many people were saved from a life raft in particular.
Was somebody who signed in with some further information on a Gibson girl? I thought I heard somebody say something there. About the only reason I could think that you would drop one with a parachute to somebody that's down on the ground or in the water is because that gives them the ability to get on the Morse code key, assuming they got Morse code capability, and send a message back up to you. And the message, I guess, would be, please rescue me. I've been here 14 days. I'm getting very hungry. I'm getting very thirsty. Something along those lines. I'd much rather send a guy a handy talkie, but oh well. Voice is a nice way of sending information back and forth. Morse code, it's got good threshold, Morse code, but it's a much slower mode, and you gotta be in pretty good shape to be able to transmit Morse code. If you were out in the wild for 14 days, I don't know if you'd have enough wits to be able to send clean code. I think your fist would get pretty sloppy. Except for the guys I know who go to sleep listening to Morse code because it helps them sleep better. I wonder if you know of anybody like that, Mel. K2KEY with a drop. K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yep, that's my sleeping pill. Do it every day. The Gibson Girl, okay, was built by Bendix Corporation, and it was many people that were rescued, that were saved by the Gibson Girl. They literally, you know, it was actually copied off of, it was an actress and the Shape, I forgot, she was like the promoter or something. It was a whole thing, World War II, I remember. Seeing something about that, about it, and they had another name for it. There was, besides the Gibson Girl, they had another name for it at one time. It was named after an actress that was very voluptuous, as they say, during the 1930s and 40s. I can't remember her name. Anybody can recall it? Over.
I'm going to make a guess of Mae West. Why don't you come up and see me sometime? But that's just a guess. But back to you, Mel.
Okay, right. The Mae West was the life jacket, and the Gibson Girl, that's what I was trying to remember, and the Gibson Girl was the transmitter. And according to the guys that knew about it, that, you know, and Floyd Bennett, when I was looking it over, I gave it a crank, they said that there were a lot of rescues. Oh, my God, there were so many ships that were torpedoed during World War II, right out here in the Atlantic Ocean. And what they did is they picked up the signal either at the Brooklyn Army Terminal. Bush Terminal had those two massive towers up there that were monitoring, and also Floyd Bennett. And, in fact, my father was a radio operator there at the Bush Terminal that set up during World War II. Now, like I say, it was quite a valuable piece of equipment for people that were, you know, all of a sudden had the ship blown out from under them, and they got in into the life raft. And of course, many of them had the radio operator with them, so he was able to crank it and send some SOS and maybe give approximate He gave us the approximate position for the rescue craft that would fly out of Floyd Bennett, those amphibians that I think we looked at one, Dick. You remember? One of those amphibious planes. So that was really the background on Gibson Girl and the idea of having the so-called only thing that was available in those days. Remember, there was no handy talkies like we have today, over.
Yeah, the so-called walkie-talkie, I think, was just barely invented near the end of World War II or even after it. Hey, I'm starting to hear a little bit more of the story of your lifestyle there, Mel. The fact that your father was a radio operator at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, if I understand correctly, that gives me a little bit more of an understanding of where your early interest in the subject came from. I think it was like 15 years of age when you already had your general class license. Is that true? Go ahead.
I was even younger than that. Had it at 14, Dick. I still have his straight key, which I use every year. We have the straight key night coming up in December, and I have his headphones. You know, they have special headphones for CW operators during World War II. So I have the headphones, and I have the straight key, which I use, I could say, in December when we have the straight key night. Now, we were talking about this dielectrics and all. You know, you got to remember, it does lead over to something very interesting in ham radio. If you're doing a vertical reflection coefficient measurement, in other words, if you have a vertical antenna, you would like to measure the radiation pattern over, say, real Earth or something. If you looked at, they have a chart called the Suedo-Brewster angle, or PBA. So if you take the frequency, and you know the dielectric constant of the soil and the conductivity, as you say, is Siemens per meter, that will go over to a PBA angle, Suedo-Brewster angle, which is in degrees, I believe. Am I correct on this, Dick? I'm sure you're more familiar with it. I'm just recalling it, over.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with it, Mel, but I am guessing that what you're pronouncing as suedo is pseudo. Is it possible that you're talking about pseudo-Brewster angle? And Brewster angle, by the way, refers to the fact that when a electromagnetic wave, whether it be light or radio, goes from one medium to another medium and strikes the interface at an angle, say, for instance, light entering water. If, for instance, you put a great big long rod or a ruler into a pool of water and you do it at a 45-degree angle, and you look at the apparent ruler below the water line when it goes into the water at a 45-degree angle, you'll recognize the fact that it the light bends in a funny way, and the ruler looks like it's got a sudden bend in it right at the water line. Well, that's Snell's law that determines that one. When it comes to vertically polarized electromagnetic energy striking a dielectric medium like water at a particular angle, there is a particular angle where the internal reflection behaves in a peculiar way so that the signal no longer reflects off the water. Whenever electromagnetic wave comes down at some particular angle, like a 45-degree angle, into nice, smooth water, no waves in it yet, to keep it simple, some of the wave goes into the water and bends in a funny way, bends up closer to the so-called normal line, and some of it reflects off the surface. At the magic Brewster angle, the reflection off the surface goes to zero. And that's a function of resistivity and
at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
So that magic angle, let me drop. That magic angle where the surface reflection for vertical polarization disappears is called the Brewster angle. But you don't have a nice, clear, flat surface of a fluid like an ocean when you're talking about a radio wave above a a mixed medium called Earth. Medium, mixed medium, I'm saying, because it's got fluids, it's got minerals, it's got dielectric constant, it's got soil, it's got clay.